You see, after I got back from study in England, I hadn't gone over directly with a high school buddy. A high school buddy had gone off. He wanted to go to Europe after he got out of high school. So he did, and he ended up in Morocco. So he got turned on to hashish and all that wonderful stuff. And he brought a lot back, a couple of pounds, and of keef, not hash. And meanwhile, while we were out of the country, marijuana had been invented in Vancouver. So there was sort of an active soft drug scene moving through the Tish Poets. Right? Somebody knew somebody who was getting it from Mexico, blah, blah, blah. So people were getting high. And I remember I went over to my friend's place one day, my high school buddy who went to Morocco. And he lived in a garage out behind his folks' place. And we went out there and sat down, and he turned this tape recorder on. And these voices are talking, and it's not really making a lot of sense, but it sounds interesting. I have no idea what's going on. And so he turns off the tape, and he's got this wild look in his eye, and he just says, "Peyote, man." He recorded a peyote high, his first, with the guy who got it for him. So peyote started coming in to Vancouver starting about 62, 63. And it was legal in those days. There was no import ban on the substance. You had to go and get a agricultural import license from Ottawa. And once you had that, you just sent a copy of that down to Laredo, New Mexico, and they sent you as many as you wanted. Yeah, either dried or green. So peyote was making the rounds, and through that scene, I met a couple of people, and I think that's actually how I ultimately connected with Sam. So whether Sam was involved with psychedelic substances prior to going over to northern India or post, I can't be sure. It's possible it was prior, but I don't think so. I don't think so. From what my son's told me, he's hiked the Himalayas. You can just kind of wander around up there and kind of pick the pot right off the plants as you're
no kidding.
Traveling the trails and dry it out for a couple of days, rolled up and smoking. So, I mean, you know, ganja is like almost a sacrament, I think, in India. So.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. So it's quite commonplace.
Ganja stores. The way we go to the liquor store, they go to the ganja store. It's hash for
really?
The most part. Yeah.
Oh, and still? I guess.
I don't know about today, but uh-huh, it definitely uh-huh. was that state of affairs in the 1960s.
Right.
And anyway, there was this peyote scene. Jim Paul seemed to be at the center of it. He was the weirdest. But there was another guy. He called himself Easter Egg. He got way too far into peyote. And I guess was one of the early casualties. I don't know if he ended up in the puzzle factory or dead, but he's gone wherever he went. I don't know. And it was, you know, through this psychedelic scene that influences were being felt in the Tish group and everybody else, you know. I mean, after you've had peyote, you think, geez, I wonder if so-and-so might like to try this, you know. So there was quite a lot of experimentation with peyote. I didn't have LSD till I'd taken peyote half a dozen times. I didn't like LSD compared to peyote. It really sucks. LSD is a terrible truck. But a lot of people seem to like it. And Sam got involved with it somehow. And that whole scene around Richard Alpert, Timothy Leary, a whole front band for them, was moving around trying to market the stuff. Somehow Sam got involved in the middle of all that. It went very, very badly somehow. I don't know what the details are. Hmm. I just know that Sam lost his mind. You know. And I felt pretty bad because that day I was over to talk to him about that perforated screen. I was returning some books that he'd loaned me. I was on my way to Montreal. And he asked me, or I asked him, I said, "Where would you like these books?" And he said, "Oh, just in that drawer." So I opened this drawer, and there's a .32 automatic in there. And I really couldn't ignore it. I said, "Hey, Sam, what do you got this for?" He said, "Oh, when I was up in the mountains in northern India, I was traveling with a wife and kid." And he said, "There's bandits up there, and I just had it for protection." logical idea. Sure. And then I forgot about it. And even when he was becoming unhinged, I'd forgotten about it. And yet I knew he had a gun. And I didn't take steps to make sure he didn't have a gun. So I felt pretty bad when I found out he shot himself with it. Jesus Christ. I knew, but I didn't act. But it's not like I consciously knew. I'd forgotten about the goddamn gun. Right? If I'd remembered it, I probably would have gotten some guys together and we would have made sure that he didn't have it
anymore. Because you knew he was messed up or messing
up. Well, I thought maybe he was just a little too high. You know, none of us were deeply experienced with what these drugs can do. You know, you hear rumors and stuff, but... you know, you just take some vitamin B and you come down and, you know, you'll be okay. But he kept going further and further and further.
So was he married and had a family at that time?
He had a wife, I think at least one, maybe more than one child, Beth Perry. But he was fooling around with Barbara Budd and probably others. And just no one could reach him. You know, he just went further and further and further into this possibly psychedelic drug-induced psychosis that turned paranoid.
So had we done the TRIPS festivals and all of that?
This was post.
This was post. Mm-hmm. So there was a very rich sort of culture developed between, you know, the Tisch poet scene and the, you know, openings into peyote and stuff like that, and and his final demise. I mean, there was all this, there was a lot of, you know, concerts and projections and
tremendously,
you know, happenings and
tremendously productive period.
That would be between what, 64 and 66 or 67? Oh, he died.
Well,
in 66?
I would date it. I mean, in terms of my own experience of the scene, mine commenced about 1963, after I left home and left art school. That was 63, and that's when I began, you know, running into people like Claude Breeze and Jerry Gilbert and Rook, who had been my painting teacher at the Vancouver School of Art. So I already knew him, but it became a more personal relationship out on the street, because he was deeply friendly with John Newlove and Jerry Gilbert and Ricardo Gomez from California. And so for me, it's 63 to 66. Mm-hmm. That three-year period, the Sound Gallery opened up on 4th. You know, Al and Greg and I can't remember. I don't think Richard was the bass player in those days, but it was a trio of some kind. You'll have to ask
Greg. Was Marguerite a part of that, or was that later? Was she later?
I think she was just a tad later.
Right. And Helen Goodwin was...
Mm-hmm. Helen was involved. Sam, of course, he had all the projectors and all these amazing ideas about, wouldn't it be cool to like project on mirrors and reflect the images back on the wall across, right? Hanging mirrors that, of course, moved with the air. So the projections were all being skewed by this movement of the reflective surface. And all this was happening in 64, latter 64, and into 65. And some of the members were so enchanted with the availability of drugs that they started getting involved with everything. Bobby Hogg, for example, got pretty far into heroin. He got himself out, fortunately, but he went into heroin. Several others got involved with heroin.
Well, was Al into heroin at that time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was constantly getting beaten up on Hastings in Maine by the narcotics officers who had taken a dislike to him. And, you know, they'd go down to the Blue Eagle and score, and then when they come out, the cops would grab him. And what I remember Al saying was, you'd try and swallow it, right, in a rubber bag or plastic bag or something and excrete it later. But so that'd be this choking routine of trying to get you to spit out what you were trying to swallow. And just horrible, you know, like just real police brutality par excellence. So, yeah, the drug scene was intense. And those of us who weren't gun shy of things like needles were starting to explore methadone injections, heroin injections, and all that stuff. I was just so spooked by fucking needles all my life that I just could never get involved with that. You know? But the marijuana, the hashish, the peyote, real interesting. Yeah.
But by the time you were doing the sound gallery thing, mm-hmm. with Al and Sam and mm-hmm. Helen and so on and mm-hmm. so on, Dennis and so on mm-hmm. and so forth, was that was there a sense of it being an art project?
No. I think in my own case it was driven by a couple of different forces. There was the emergence of McLuhan and the accessibility of his ideas for anybody who was interested in that kind of stuff. That was pretty exciting stuff, you know, to rethink your relationship to your environments as influential forces called media, technology. And the other thing, I don't hear this spoken about by very many other people, but I grew up in that whole Cold War nuclear terror nightmare, you know, duck and cover and having to lie down on the curbside. You know, they had air raid siren drills, and if you're outside, you're supposed to practice by lying down beside the curb on the street. In other words, the idea that, yeah, there's these guys over here, and there's these other guys here, and they don't get along very well, and there's a strong possibility they're going to blow the whole fucking world up. So, living with that idea, it seemed that, hey, you want to make a painting? You better do it now because there might not be a tomorrow. Hey, you want to get high? You might as well do it today because there might not be another opportunity. It was all right here, right now. Just whatever you want to get done, get into it right away because there may not be another opportunity. It was that kind of thing driving my intelligence, my sensibility. And, of course, it went through the archway of art, but it wasn't so much a conscious awareness of doing anything artistic in terms of these collaborative explorations with technology and other artists in other disciplines like dance or writing or music. It wasn't a sense of doing anything revolutionary. It was just doing stuff that was interesting to do because
it was being done.
Pardon me?
It was being done. I mean, was this a game of catch-up with like, New York?
Oh, there's certainly the resonance of how people in other parts of the world, other cities in North America, were dealing with the kind of pressures that I was conscious of. I mean, the fact that there was this threat to civilization that could be over in a couple of minutes. Their explorations were pretty interesting. So whether that was just in the air or whether really literate guys like Al Neal reading about it and talking about it and spreading the word, so to speak, I really don't know.
Right, but when you were in London, you were exposed to that kind of culture.
Well, I was exposed to a tremendous amount of painting and sculpture, British and American.
And was peripheral to that, the sort of the notion of happenings and events?
Well, there was an awareness of, besides all the painting and stuff, there was these other activities going on, and they certainly appealed to me at the time as pretty interesting. Paintings, but or using paint, but not on canvas, just painting on cardboard or wood or whatever, and getting involved with light and color through electricity and sound and all of that. It was interesting that there were people trying alternative approaches to creating some kind of aesthetic experience that wasn't completely anchored in traditional practice like stretching canvases or chipping away at big hunks of wood or marble or casting metals or something. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Alternatives were being explored. And I didn't have any sense of trying to play catch-up with the rest of the world. No. It just seemed to be what was appropriate to be doing at the time.
Right. But it was a radical departure. I mean, in a sense, when you look at, you look at the art in Vancouver in particular that was being done up till that time, it was very traditional. Perhaps not traditional in the eyes of the artists who were doing it, but...
Well, traditional in terms of the marketplace and the influence of commodification on the arts that's been there for a long time, the making of a print or a drawing or a painting and arranging for it to be presentable in public and for sale, that's what was going on. But some of the painting was pretty good, you know, or some of the artwork, both two-dimensional and three-dimensional art, was pretty good. I think of people like Tony Only and Don Jarvis. I mean, they weren't painting, you know, pretty, you know, still lives and figures and landscapes in the traditional sense. They were trying to break with all of that as modernism had been trying to do for most of the century. But yeah, at that marketplace level, it was very conventional. Yeah, it wasn't going outside that box.
And suddenly, you know, the activities that you were involved in...
They were outside that box.
Outside the box.
Totally outside that box, yeah. They weren't commercial. In other words, the Sound Gallery was really operating on donations, you know. In other words, if you came through the door and you had a few coins in your pocket or could spare a little folding money, you would just put it in the can. And that helped pay the rent, keep the lights on, the electricity flowing and stuff like that. That's how it was being dealt with. It's probable that people like Sam were making sure it was all covered, and if it wasn't, he would attend to it, you know. I certainly wasn't involved at that level at that stage. After we moved down to Seymour Street, I was, but in terms of what happened on Fourth Avenue, no.
So there was money around. Obviously, there was money
was
around.
If
a number of people...
Yeah, I don't know if there was money around... In the big sense.
Well, there was food.
Well,
there was food and shelter.
It was a very, very different economy. You could have a one, maybe two-bedroom apartment, nice, comfortable environment for 65 to 75, maybe 85 bucks a month, right? I think gas was like, what, 30 cents a gallon? I mean, the economy was really different. And... you know, a dollar or two went a ways. You know, you could buy a lot of stuff with a buck. You could get bread and milk and cheese and a pack of cigarettes. Okay. And you still got money left over after they changed your $5, right? That all, of course, began a downward spiral in the early 70s with the OPEC crisis.
So that was the post-war boom.
That was, I guess, the last wave of the post-war economy. That's right. That's right.
So, yes,
you're right in qualifying it as, yeah, there was money around. I was working at the bookstore. Claude was working at the bookstore. I mean, you know, we were salaried employees. We had income. So, yeah, there was money around, and money bought a lot. Money went a long ways in those days. And mind you, I don't think I had a phone till 68. I thought it was more important to have a typewriter than a phone, so I'd always rent a typewriter and have one of those around. I still don't like phones. If I didn't have to have one, I wouldn't, but I have to have one. Mm-hmm. But do you understand what I'm saying about the forces sort of driving the personality? I mean, it was the drug culture, right? The conceptual culture, which for me was driven by McLuhan and related individuals, and then the whole zeitgeist, you know, the ambience was crisis, you know, nuclear annihilation. And under those conditions, I was operating quite consciously. Others, I think, perhaps were acting unconsciously. You know, they're aware of it, but not consciously, and responding in a fashion that they felt or believed was appropriate. Sure, take it outside the commercial box. Who cares, right? May not even be here tomorrow, so what the fuck, you know? Like, just do it, and see what happens. Maybe something interesting will happen, and we'll still be here tomorrow to try something else. That kind of day-to-day kind of process of discovery and exploration, you know. The geography, the social geography of all this is pretty complicated to map for one person, you know? And I had contact with the painting scene through Roy, and Claude Breeze, the writing scene through Jerry Gilbert and John Newlove, the drug scene through my high school buddy, and then the other people who were involved with it, and then the, I think the real interdisciplinary stuff was through Al Neal, in terms of music and Sam and Sight and Sound and all that. I mean, it's very, very complex sociology when you really want to get into the minutiae of who and what and where and when, you know. Very, very complex. I mean, you're hearing me talk about stuff I haven't thought about in years, you know.